Recently in Oakland, a group of mothers occupied a vacant home, highlighting a housing problem that's growing across the U.S. According to a 2019 census report, a little over 12% of units in our country were vacant. An estimated 4,000 parcels are empty in Oakland, a city also grappling with rising homelessness. One solution is a so-called vacancy tax, and we wanted to learn more about how these taxes work. Joining me now for more is Michael Lenz, Associate Professor of Urban Planning and Public Policy at UCLA. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we were all struck by the sheer number of vacant parcels in Oakland, upwards of 4,000 we're hearing. So when folks hear about the possibility of a vacancy tax, it sounds sort of intriguing in the context of what's happening in Oakland with so many empty parcels and homes. How does this work? How does a vacancy tax actually work?
This is not uncharted territory. You've got examples in Vancouver, in Canada, and in Washington, D.C., but we don't have a lot of data to draw on just yet or experiences. But, you know, the way this would work is you have to have some active data collection on what parcels, what units are vacant out there. And you would like to know a little bit more about why, because vacancies do carry different characteristics. Things are vacant for different reasons. You know, you might have some laws in there about different landowners and treating different landowners differently based on could range from income to where they reside, and things of that nature. So, you know, this is a solution that could take a lot of different forms, I think.
I want to get to something that you just said about the different reasons are really important, because oftentimes high vacancy rates, they're indicative of a low demand for housing. But in some of the places that are actually thinking about this as a solution, including Los Angeles, there are parts of the city where there's a huge demand for it. And yet we're talking about using this as a means, as part of a larger solution. Can you talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, I think a classic refrain that you hear right now in a hot housing market like Los Angeles is that we're building too many, quote unquote, luxury housing units, right? And so we're only building for a certain market segment at the very top of the income range and the price range, and we're overbuilding in that sector, and we're not building enough for people who are of lower means. And so, if we're building too much, a lot of that stock goes unused and remains vacant. I think there's still a lot to learn about how frequent that is. You know, a lot of times new housing remains vacant for a period of time while buildings fill up, whether that's, you know, leasing up or selling condos. So we have to collect good data and timely data to know exactly what is vacant, for how long, why, and, you know, is there some reason to believe that there is land speculation that is driving, you know, some of this vacancy.
I want to ask you about another place, Detroit, where 16% of homes are vacant. And the Detroit Land Bank has become the owner of thousands of foreclosed homes. It's a different situation, of course. But how does it help us understand what situations can or can't be fixed by a vacancy tax?
Right. So the story in Detroit is often that you may have, you know, bought this house 20, 30 years ago, and it's impossible to sell, you know, above, say, $50,000, $100,000, and that's not going to make up for the amount that you've lost, or you're underwater on a loan or something like that. And so hanging on to a vacant property in that situation, hoping that at some point things turn around, is a very different process, but mirrors really what we think of as speculation, right? Where in a hot market, the speculator is holding on to something that they hope they can sell at a profit later on. But, you know, in one case, we've got, say, a grandmother in Detroit, and the other case, we've got a foreign investor in Los Angeles. We want to treat those two people very differently, but they might be hoping for the same outcome at the end.
Mm-hmm. Housing has always been a story about race and economics.
Absolutely.
How does a vacancy tax get at the core issue, or does it at all?
I think it's a good time to reflect on MLK's legacy, certainly in the context of the housing question, right? And later in his career, he was did a lot of work on housing segregation, particularly later in his career. And I think this is the vacancy tax is another colorblind solution to a problem that involves race very commonly, right? If you think about eviction, if you think about homelessness, if you think about the negative impacts of segregation, both by race and class in our housing markets, this is a problem that is often very concentrated in particular communities amongst households of color. And so a vacancy tax is not getting at those root problems. It's not getting at those root causes that go back to Martin Luther King's time and before, right? And you know, that some of these a vacancy tax can have some positive outcomes for people who are struggling the most if we use the money that the tax would raise in an appropriate way. But again, it's not getting at the root causes of our housing problems, which are myriad, but certainly have a lot to do with race.
Yeah. What are some of the pushbacks against a vacancy tax?
Well, some of the pushback that you get is the pushback that you would get for any tax, right? That there are already too many taxes for too many purposes, right? And people are overburdened, whether they're landowners or not. And also, you can scare away investment that you might actually want.
Mm.
That can move across borders pretty easily if a city is the implementer of a tax like this.
So a developer, for instance, who might want to develop a high rise, but knowing that they have to be assured that they actually have occupancy, and they know there's a vacancy tax within that municipality, might just say, oh, I'll go to this other city.
Exactly. So geographic boundaries are much smaller, and the cost of moving from Los Angeles to Culver City or Beverly Hills to do your property investment is a lot lower than if, you know, the state of California said, we're going to do a vacancy tax. And so then everybody in the LA metro area, everybody in the San Francisco area would be subject to that. And so you couldn't easily move across borders in that way.
Yeah. You're thinking very deeply about this all of the time. What are some very tangible ways that we can really get at this issue of housing inequity?
Well, I think the time is right now to directly target people who are struggling the most in a more generous way. We do not allow housing subsidies to be considered an entitlement, right? We do not give people housing subsidies if they qualify all of the time, right? We have long waiting lists for lotteries to get into public housing, to get into other below market rate housing, to obtain vouchers for affording a home. And we have these massive homelessness crises, and we can't build fast enough to accommodate that. But we also need to build faster, right? And so I think subsidies increase supply, and trying to protect tenants in the places where they are, whether that is through eviction defense, rent control, other means of protecting tenants where they are and making sure they don't have to move.
Yeah. And on a human level, really thinking beyond who deserves housing and who doesn't. Because fundamentally, that's what race comes down to. That's what the issue of class comes down to, is in a capitalist society, who we think deserves based on their worth.
Right. And I don't think we've resolved that question in housing in particular. You know, there's always been a strong movement that housing is a human right. But we tend to protect property interests and property as something that people earn in ways that are not universal.
That's Michael Lenz, Associate Professor of Urban Planning and Public Policy and Director of the Lewis Center for Regional Policy Studies. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.